It was the cold light of early dawn. And how sadly, how soberly it lit that room which deceitful candles made so gorgeous. We saw now what we had never seen before. How the moth had nibbled the upholstery, the mice had gnawed away the Persian carpets, and dust caked all the cornices. The luxury of that place had been nothing but illusion, created by the candles of midnight, and in the dawn all was sere, worn out, decay. We saw the stains of damp and mould on ceilings and the damask walls. The gilding on the mirrors was all tarnished, and a bloom of dust obscured the glass, so that when we looked within them, there we saw not the fresh young women that we were, but the hags we would become, and knew that we too, like pleasures, were mortal. Then we understood the house had served its turn for us, for the parlour itself began to waver and dissolve before our very eyes. Even the solidity of the sofas seemed called into question, for they and the heavy leather armchairs now had the dubious air of furniture, carved out of smoke. "Come now," cried Esmeralda, never one to mope. "What say we give the good old girl a funeral pyre like the pagan kings of old, and cheat the reverend out of his inheritance to boot? Off she runs to the kitchen and comes back with a can of kerosene. We all make haste to shift our bits and bobs out on the lawn, clear of the conflagration, and then we ritually anoint the walls and portals of the old place with oil, sir. Thoroughly soak the cellars, drench the damn beds, dust the carpets. Lizzie, as she had been the housekeeper, sought for herself the last task of tidying up. She struck the match." "I wept," said Lizzie. "We girls stood on the lawn, and the morning wind off the river whipped our skirts about us. We shivered from the cold, from anxiety, from sorrow at the end of one part of our lives and the exhilaration of our new beginnings. When the fire had fairly taken hold, off we went, Indian file, clutching our bundles up the towpath, until we got to the main road and found a rank of sleepy cabbies under the tower, only too pleased to see custom at that hour in the morning. We kissed and parted, and went each our separate ways. And so the first chapter of my life went up in flames, sir."
Chapter 3
"What a long drive it was to Battersea, but such a welcome when we got there. The little nieces and nephews jumping up from the breakfast table to throw their arms around us. Isotta running to put fresh coffee on. A little old-fashioned family life did not come amiss to either of us after so long of the other kind, and we'd help out in the shop. I would turn the crank of the ice-cream machine in the mornings, while Feathers, discreetly shrouded in a shawl, would man the counter. Hokey pokey, penny a lump, the more you eat, the more you jump. I love to be among the little children, sir. How I love to hear their prattling, their little voices lisping merry rhymes. Oh, sir, can you think of a more innocent way of earning a living than to sell good ice cream at modest prices to little children, after so many years of selling tricks to dirty old men? Why, each day in that white, well-scrubbed, shining ice cream parlour, what a positive purification. Don't you think, sir, that in heaven we shall all eat nothing but ice cream?" Feathers smiled beatifically, belched, and interrupted herself. "Here, Liz, is there a bite left to eat in the place? I'm starved again. All this talking about myself, sir, Gord, takes the strength out of you." Lizzie peered beneath the napkin in the basket, but found nothing except dirty crockery. "Tell you what, love," she said, "I'll just slip out to the all-night cab stand in Piccadilly for a bacon sandwich, shall I? No, sir, put away your money. Our treat." Lizzie briskly slipped a jacket of grey, disturbingly anonymous fur over her dress and speared a queer little, still little round black hat to her cropped head with a savage pin. She was still fresh as a daisy. She tossed Walser a gratuitously ironic leer as she ducked out of the door. Now Walser was alone with the giantess, who fell silent, as she had done the first time Lizzie left them alone together, and turned back to the inverted world of her mirror, in which she stroked an eyebrow, as if it were imperative for her peace of mind that she set the hairs in perfect order. Then, perhaps hoping their scent would refresh her, She pulled her violets dripping from the jam jar and buried her face in them. Perhaps she was tiring. After she'd imbibed whatever virtue she might obtain from her violets, she yawned. But not as a tired girl yawns. Feathers yawned with prodigious energy, opening up a crimson maw the size of that of a basking shark, taking in enough air to lift a Montgolfier. And then she stretched herself suddenly, and hugely, extending every muscle as a cat does, until it seemed she intended to fill up all the mirror, all the room with her bulk. As she raised her arms, Walser, confronted by stubbled, thickly powdered armpits, felt faint. God, she could easily crush him to death in her huge arms, although he was a big man with the strength of Californian sunshine distilled in his limbs. A seismic erotic disturbance convulsed him, unless it was their damn champagne. He scrambled to his feet, suddenly panicking, scattering underwear, grazing his scalp painfully on the mantelpiece. Ouch! Excuse me, ma'am, the call of nature? If he got out of her room for just one moment, was allowed, however, briefly to stand by himself in the cold, grimy passage, away from her presence, if he could fill his lungs just the one time with air that was not choking with essence of feathers, then he might recover his sense of proportion. "Piss in the pot behind the screen, love. Go on. We don't stand on ceremony. But go on." It seemed he must not leave the room until she and her familiar were done with him. So he humbly stepped behind the screen to direct the brown arc of the excess of her champagne as bidden into the white china pot. The act of engaging in this most human of activities brought him down to earth again, for there is no element of the metaphysical about pissing, not at least in our culture. As he buttoned his fly, earthiness reasserted itself all around him. The dressing room suddenly sizzled with the salt, savoury smell of fried bacon, and a hand holding the brown teapot appeared around the screen and upended the cold contents into Feather's dirty bathwater, on the scummed grey surface of which the last deposit of tea leaves already floated. When he emerged from behind the screen, the passage door stood open, and a welcome draught freshened up the crusted air. The room echoed with the melody of running water and the chink of the plumbing as Lizzie refilled the kettle at the tap in the passage. Walser sighed with reassurance. "Hark!" said Feathers, raising her hand. On the soundless air of night came the ripple of Big Ben. Lizzie slammed the door as she came back to put the kettle on the hissing stove. The mauve and orange flames dipped and swayed. Big Ben concluded the run-up, struck, and went on striking. Walser relapsed on the sofa, dislodging not only a slithering mass of silken underthings, but also the concealed layers of pamphlets and newspapers that lay beneath them. Muttering apologies, he bundled together the musky garments, but Lizzie, chattering with rage, snatched the papers from him and stuffed them away in the corner cupboard. Odd, that she did not want him to examine her old newspaper. But odder still, Big Ben had once again struck midnight. The time outside still corresponded to that registered by the stopped gilt clock inside. Inside and outside matched exactly, but both were badly wrong. He rejected a bacon sandwich. The strips of rusty meat slapped between the doorsteps of white bread seemed to him for dire extremities of hunger only. But Feathers tucked in with relish, a vigorous mastication of large teeth, a smacking of plump lips smeared with grease. Lizzie passed him a fresh mug of black tea for him to burn his gullet with. Everything aggressively normal about all this, except the hour. The food put fresh heart into the aerialiste. Her backbone firmed up, and she began to glow again, quite brightly, as she wiped her mouth once more on her sleeve, leaving behind shining traces of bacon fat on the grubby satin. "As I was saying," she resumed, "we lived for a while at Isotta's in Battersea, amid all the joys of home. And an especial joy, we were just a hop and a skip and a jump away from the good old Vic at Waterloo, where, at very reasonable prices, we perched up in the gods and wept at Romeo and Juliet, booed and hissed at Crookback Dick, laughed ourselves silly at Malvolio's yellow stockings.
"We dearly love the bard, sir," said Lizzie briskly. "What spiritual sustenance he offers.
And we take in a bit of opera, too. Our favourite, sir, why?"
"Marriage of Figaro, for the class analysis," offered Lizzie, deadpan. Feather's hearty laughter did not quite conceal her irritation.
"Oh, Liz, you are a one. As for me, sir, I've a special fondness for Bizet's Carmen, due to the spirit of the heroine."
She subjected Walser to a blue bombardment from her eyes, challenge and attack at once, before she took up the narrative again.
"So, there we were in Battersea. Happy days, but a fearful cold winter came on with very little call for ice cream, and Gianni, Isotta's husband, my brother-in-law, Gianni's chest got very bad. They having the five little ones and another in the pot with trade going so bad, we were hard put to manage, I can tell you. Then the baby fell sick, and would take no nourishment, and we was all crazed with worry.
One morning, the elder kid is at school, Gianni out on business in the freezing November fog, poor soul, with his cough, Isotta, upstairs grieving over the baby, myself in the kitchen chopping candied peel, Feathers in the room behind the shop, teaching the four-year-old her letters.
Though I know I should have no favourites among them, and truly I love them all as if they was my own, well, my Violetta...
She reached out to caress the bunch of Parma violets on her dressing table, with a smile that, for once, was not meant for Walser to see.
"My Violetta on my knee. We explore together the adventures of A and B and C, when comes a jangle on the bell, and there in the shop is the strangest old lady that ever I saw, dressed up in the clothes of her youth, that is to say some 50 years behind the times, a dress of black chiffon that looked like rags hung over such a massive taffeta petticoat you couldn't see at first how thin she was, that she was a lady all skin and bone. On her head, she wore an old-fashioned poke bonnet of dull black satin with jet ornaments at either side, and a black spotted veil hanging down in front, so thick you could not see her face.
"Let me through into the back room, Winged Victory," she said, and she had a voice like the wind in telegraph wires.
Violetta burst out crying at the sight of my visitor, and I hustled her off into the kitchen to get a treat of nuts and citron off Lizzie. But I was a good deal discomposed by this apparition too, and set her by the fire on the best chair, for you could tell she was a perfect gentlewoman, with stammerings and nervous fussings, quite unlike myself. She stretched her hand towards the flames. She had those great auntish black lace mittens on, that go no further than the first joint of the fingers and thumbs, so all you could see of her hands was bone and nail.
"I reckon you've fallen on hard times since Nelson went," she says.
"I won't say things are rosy," says I, although her very presence made me shudder, and throughout our interview she never lifts her veil.
"Well, Feathers," she says, "I've a proposition for you."
And with that names me a figure that takes my breath away.
"And never any need to do the thing, oh, rest assured," she tells me. "Not till you want to, that is."
So I realise she's heard all about me. How I was Ma Nelson's flagship but always kept out of the battle, that Nelson never brought me to the block, so I was known to all the nether side of London as the Virgin Whore.
"I want you for my Museum of Women Monsters," she says. "Take your time about making up your mind."
Rising, she leaves a card on the mantelpiece and departs, and looking after her at the shop door, I see a little old-fashioned carriage all closed in, drawn by a little black pony, and on the box, a black man with this mournful peculiarity. He had been born without a mouth. Then the sour brown fog rising from the river swallowed them up. But I heard the hooves trotting towards Chelsea Bridge, although the wheels I could not hear since they were solid rubber.
"It was the famous Madame Schreck," said Lizzie tonelessly, as if the mention of the name was sufficient bad news in itself.
"Famous indeed. Walser knew of her already. Vague rumours in men's clubs, over brandy and cigars. The name, never accompanied by guffaws, leers, nudges in the ribs, but by bare, hinted whispers of the profoundly strange, of curious revelations that greeted you behind Our Lady of Terror's triple-locked doors,
doors that opened reluctantly, with a great rattling of bolts and chains, and then swung to with a long groan, as of despair. "Madame Shrek," wrote Walser. The story was about to take a grisly turn.
"Oh, my poor girl," exclaimed Lizzie on a sigh. If only the baby had not taken a turn for the worse. Oh, and if only Gianni's cough had not turned septic, so he had to take to his bed. If only Isotta never took such a tumble down the stairs that the doctor swore she must spend the last 3 months of her time flat on her back on the kitchen sofa. Oh, Mr. Walser, the dolorous litany of the misfortunes of the poor is a string of if-onlys.
Had not the doctor's bills that winter swallowed up all our savings, and as for the activities of the special branch...
This time it was Lizzie who kicked furiously at Feather's ankle, and the girl never missed a beat of her narrative, but went smoothly on a different tack.
And the little one staring starvation in the face. Oh, if our household had not been overwhelmed by an accumulation of those unpredictable catastrophes that precipitate poor folk such as we into the abyss of poverty through no fault of their own.
"Don't do it, Fevers," Gianni begged her, but then he coughed up blood.
So rising early one morning before the house was awake, when nobody could stop me, leaving Lizzie sleeping in our bed, I hastily packed a few things in a carpet bag, and not forgetting my pet talisman, my Nelson's toy sword, to give me courage, I left a scribble message on the kitchen table and trudged over Chelsea Bridge just as the moon was setting. It was bitter, bitter cold, and even at Nelson's funeral was my heart never so heavy. As I reached the last lamppost on the bridge, out it blinked, and I lost sight of Battersea in the darkness before dawn.
Chapter 4
"You filled up your notebook," observed Lizzie.
Walser reversed it in order to give himself a fresh set of blank pages. He sharpened his pencil with the razor blade he always carried in an inner pocket for the purpose. He flexed his aching wrist. Lizzie, as if rewarding him for these activities, refilled his mug, and Feathers held out her mug for more tea too.
"Thirsty work, this autobiography," she said.
Her exuberant hair was beginning to escape from Lizzie's hairpins and frolic here and there along her bullish nape.
"Mr. Walser," she went on earnestly, spinning on her stool towards him, "you must understand this. Nelson's Academy accommodated those who were perturbed in their bodies and wished to verify that however equivocal, however much they cost, the pleasures of the flesh were at bottom splendid. But as for Madame Shrek, she catered for those who were troubled in their souls."
Darkly, she turned her attention for a moment to her treacly tea.
"It was a gloomy pile in Kensington, in a square with a melancholy garden in the middle, full of warm grass and leafless trees. The facade of her house was blackened by the London soot, as if the very stucco were in mourning. A lowering portico over the front door, sir, and all the inner shutters tightly barred, and the door knocker most ominously bandaged up in crape. That self-same fellow with no mouth, poor thing, opens the door to me after a good deal of unbolting from the inside, and bids me come in with eloquent gestures of his hands. I never saw eyes so full of sorrow as his were, sorrow of exile and of abandonment. His eyes said, clear as his lips could have, 'Oh, girl, go home, save yourself while there is yet time,' even while he takes away my hat and shawl. But I am the same poor creature of necessity as he, and as he must stay, then so needs I. Early as it was in the morning for a house of pleasure, it was not yet 7, Madame Shrek, it seems, was wide awake, but still in bed, taking her chocolate. She had me sit myself down and have a cup with her, which I did willingly enough in spite of my trepidation, for that long walk had worn me out and I was starving hungry. The shutters were up, the blinds down, her heavy curtains drawn across, and the only light in her bedroom a little nightlight, or corpse light, on the mantel. So I was hard put to it to see what witch's broth there is in my cup, and she's laid out in an old four-poster with the embroidered hangings pulled almost together, so I can't make out the face or shape of her, and all cold as hell." "I'm glad to see you, Feathers," she says,
and her voice was like wind in graveyards.
Toussaint will show you to your quarters presently, and you can take a rest until dinner time, after which we shall measure you for your costume.
From the way she said it, you'd think that costume was to be a winding sheet. As my eyes grew used to the penumbra, I saw the only furniture in the room besides her bed and my chair was a safe the size of a wardrobe with the biggest brass combination lock on it than I ever did see, and a desk with a roll top all locked up. That was all she spoke to me. I made haste to finish my chocolate, I can tell you. Then the manservant Toussaint, with the tenderest gesture, covers my eyes up with his hand, and when he uncovers, Madame Schreck is up and dressed and stood there before me in her black dress and a thick veil such as a Spanish widow wears, that comes down to her knees and her mittens on, all complete. Now, Mr. Walzer, do not think I am a faint-hearted woman, but although I knew very well it was all so much show, the black carriage, the mute, the prison chill, all the same, she had some quality of the uncanny about her, over and above the illusion, so you did think that under those lugubrious garments of hers you might find nothing but some kind of wicked puppy that pulled its own strings.
"Be off with you," she says.
But I thought of my little nephews and nieces, who that very minute would be plaguing Lizzie for a bite of breakfast when we'd shared the last crust in the house at last night's supper, and I sang out, "How about a bit on account, Madame Schreck, or else I fly straight up the chimney. You won't see me again." And I swept over to the fireplace, that ain't never seen a burned stock in its life, shoved aside the fire screen, ready to make good my promise.
"Toussaint," she says, "get in a man to block up all the chimneys immediately."
But when I started to toss the fire irons furiously this way and that way, she says reluctantly,
"Oh, very well."
Feels under her pillow for a key, takes good care to put herself fair and square between me and the safe so I can't read the combination, and in a trice, the door swings open. Aladdin's cave inside. The contents shone with her own light. Pile upon pile of golden sovereigns, her queen's ransom of diamond necklaces and pearls and rubies and emeralds, piled hugger-mugger among bankers' drafts, bills of exchange, foreclosed mortgages, etc., etc., etc. With a display of the greatest reluctance, she selects 5 sovereigns, counts them out again, and with as much painful hesitation as if they were drops of her dear heart's blood, she hands them over. What a shock I got when I felt the rasp of her fingertips on my palm, for they were indeed hard, as if there were no flesh on them. Afterwards, when I was free again, Esmeralda's old man, the human eel, told me how this Madame Schreck, as she called herself, had indeed started out life as a living skeleton, touring the sideshows, and always was a bony woman. As I goes out the bedroom, I glances over my shoulder to see what the old hag's up to now, and bugger me if she hasn't precipitated herself bodily into that safe and is hugging the riches it contains to her skinny bosom with the most vehement display of passion, making faint whinnying sounds the while. I trust Toussaint, to whom I have taken an immediate liking, to get these sovereigns straight to Battersea, lay my head on my hard flat pillow, and take immediate refuge in sleep, to wake hours later as night approaches. It was the barest, plainest chamber you ever saw, with a little iron bedstead, a deal washstand, and iron bars across the window, from which I can see the barren trees in the deserted garden, and a few lights in the houses over the square. To see those lights in happy homes brought tears to my eyes, sir, for I am in a house that shows no lights. No lights. Then it comes to me, oh, I might never leave this place, now I have come here of my own free will, that I have voluntarily incarcerated myself among the damned for the sake of money, even if from the best of motives, that my doom has come upon me. At this apocalyptic moment, the door opens, I see a shadow behind a kerosene lamp, I start up from the bed crying out, and the shadow speaks in broad Yorkshire.
"It's nobbut old family, love, don't be afeard."
And I will find the companionship of the damned my only solace. Who worked for Madame Schreck, sir? Why, prodigies of nature such as I. Dear old Fanny Four Eyes, and the Sleeping Beauty, and the Wiltshire Wonder, who was not 3 foot high, and Albert Albertina,
who was bipartite. That is to say, half and half and neither of either. And the girl we called Cobwebs. During the time I stayed at Madame Shrek's, such was the full compliment. And though she begged Toussaint to join in some of the tableau vivant, he never would, being a man of great dignity. All he did was play the organ. And there was a drunk cook in the basement, but we never saw much of her.
"This Toussaint," said Walser, tapping his pencil against his teeth.
"How did he?" "Eat, sir. Through a tube up his nose, sir. Liquids only, but sufficient to sustain life. I'm happy to say that since I began to prosper on the halls and started to frequent the company of men of science, I was able to interest Sir S.J. in Toussaint's case, and he was successfully operated upon at St. Bartholomew's Hospital 2 years ago last February. And now Toussaint has a mouth as good as yours or mine. You'll find a full account of the operation in the Lancet for June 1898, sir."
She gave him this scientific verification of Toussaint's existence with a dazzling smile. It was true that Fevers had won the friendship of many men of science. Walser recalled how the young woman had entertained the curiosity of the entire Royal College of Surgeons for 3 hours without so much as unbuttoning her bodice for them, and discussed navigation in birds with a full meeting of the Royal Society with such infernal assurance and so great a wealth of scientific terminology that not one single professor had dared to be rude enough to question her on the extent of her personal experience.
"Oh, that Toussaint," said Lizzie. "How he can move a crowd. Such eloquence the man has. Oh, if all those with such things to say had mouths. And yet it is the lot of those who toil and suffer to be dumb. But consider the dialectic of it, sir," she continued, with freshly crackling vigour. "How it was, or it were, the white hand of the oppressor, who carved open the aperture of speech in the very throat, you could say, that it had, in the first place, rendered dumb, and—"
Fevers shot Lizzie a look of such glazing fury that the witch hushed, suddenly as she'd started. Walser raised his mental eyebrows.
"More to the chaperon than met the eye."
But Fevers lassoed him with her narrative, and dragged him along with her before he'd had a chance to ask Lizzie if—
"Before he met up with Madame Shrek, sir, Toussaint used to work the shows at fairs. What they call on your side of the herring pond, the 10-in-1, sir. So he was a connoisseur of degradation, and always maintained it was those fine gentlemen who paid down their sovereigns to poke and pry at us, who were the unnatural ones, not we. For what is natural and unnatural, sir? The mould in which the human form is cast is exceedingly fragile. Give it the slightest tap with your fingers and it breaks. God alone knows why, Mr. Walser, but the men who came to Madame Shrek's were one and all quite remarkable for their ugliness. Their faces suggested that he who cast the human form in the first place did not have his mind on the job. Toussaint could hear us perfectly well, of course, and often jotted down encouraging words and sometimes little maxims on the pad he always carried with him, and he was as great a comfort and an inspiration to us in our confinement as now we will be to a greater world."
Lizzie nodded emphatically. Fevers went smoothly forward.
"Madame Shrek organised her museum thus. Downstairs, in what had used to be the wine cellar, she'd had a sort of vault or crypt constructed, with wormy beams overhead and nasty damp flagstones underfoot. And this place was known as Down Below, or else the Abyss. The girls was all made to stand in stone niches cut out of the slimy walls, except for the Sleeping Beauty, who remained prone, since proneness was her speciality. And there were little curtains in front, and in front of the curtains, a little lamp burning. These were her profane altars, as she used to call them. Some gent would knock at the front door, thumpity-thump, a soft deathly thunder due to the crepe muffler on the knocker. Toussaint would unbolt and let him in, relieve him of his top coat and topper, and put him in the little receiving room, where the punter would rummage among the clobber in the big wardrobe and rig himself out a cassock or a ballet dancer's frock, or whatever he fancied. But the one I liked least was the executioner's hood. There was a judge who come regular, who always fancied that, yet all he ever wanted was a weeping girl to spit at him.
and he'd pay 100 guineas for the privilege. Except on those days when he'd put on the black cap himself, then he'd take himself off upstairs to what Madame Schreck called the Black Theatre. And there, Albert Albertina put a noose around his neck and give it a bit of a pull, but not enough to hurt, whereupon he'd ejaculate and give him her a fiver tip. But Lars Schreck always took charge of that. When the client had donned the garments of his choice, the lights dimmed. Toussaint would scurry down below and take his place at the harmonium, which was concealed behind a pierced Gothic fold screen. He'd start pumping out some heartening tune, such as a nice Kyrie from some requiem. That was our cue to off with the shawls and jackets we'd bundled ourselves in to keep out the cold, and give over the games of bezique or backgammon with which we passed the time, climb up on our pedestals and pull the curtains shut. Then the old hag herself comes tottering down the cellar like Lady Macbeth, ushering the happy client. There'd be a lot of clanking of chains, there being several doors to open, and it was all dark but for her lantern, which was a penny candle in a skull. So we all stood to attention at our posts, and the last door opens, and in she comes like Virgil in hell, with her little Dante trotting after, wickering to himself with deliciously scarified anticipation, and the candle lantern throwing all manner of shadows on the sweating walls. She'd stop at random in front of one niche or another, and she'd say, "Shall I open the curtain? Who knows what spectacle of the freakish and unnatural lies behind it?" And they'd say, "Yes," or "No," depending on whether they'd been before, for if they'd been before, they'd got their fancies picked out. And if it was "Yes," she'd pull back the curtain while Toussaint wheezed out a shocking discord on the old harmonium. And there she'd be. It cost another 100 guineas to have the Wiltshire Wonder suck you off, and a cool 250 to take Albert Albertina upstairs, because Shahi was one of each, and then as much again while the tariff soared by leaps and bounds if you wanted anything out the ordinary. But as for me and the Sleeping Beauty, it was, "Look, don't touch," since Madame Schreck chose to dispose of us in a series of tableaux. After the door clanged shut again, I'd go and turn the light on, throw a blanket over the Sleeping Beauty, lift the Wonder off the perch from which it was too high for her to jump, and Toussaint would bring us a hot pot of coffee with a bit of brandy in it, or tea with rum, for it was perishing down there. Oh, it was easy work, all right, especially for me and the Beauty. But what I never could get used to was the sight of their eyes, for there was no terror in the house our customers did not bring with them. We were supposed to get a tenner a week each, basic, with bonuses per trick, those that turned them. But out of that, she kept a fiver each for our keep, which was scanty enough, boiled beef and carrot, spotted dog. And as to the rest, which was riches beyond the dreams of most working girls, why, we never saw a penny of it. She put it away for us in her safe. Ha ha, what a joke. Those 5 sovereigns I got out of her the first day I arrived in the house was the only cash I got in my hand all the time I worked there. For the moment that her front door shut behind you, you were her prisoner. Indeed, you were her slave. Lizzie once again crouched at Feather's feet, tugged the hem of the aerialist's dressing gown. "Tell him about the Sleeping Beauty," she prompted. "Oh, what a tragic case, sir. She was a country curate's daughter, and bright and merry as a grig, until one morning in her 14th year, the very day her menses started. She never wakened, not until noon, and the day after not until tea time, and the day after that, her grieving parents watching and praying beside her bed, she opened her eyes at supper time and said, 'I think I could fancy a little bowl of bread and milk.' So they propped her up on her pillows and fed her with a spoon, and when she'd eaten it all up, she says, 'I couldn't keep my eyes open if I tried,' and falls back asleep. And so it went on. After a week of it, then a month of it, then a year of it, Madame Schreck, chancing to hear of this great marvel, came to her village and let on she was a philanthropic gentlewoman who would take care of the poor girl and let the best doctors visit her. And Beauty's parents, getting on in years, could hardly believe their luck. She was loaded on a stretcher into the guards van of the London train, and so to Kensington.
where her life went on as it had done before. She always woke at sunset, like night-scented stock. She ate, she filled a bedpan, and then she slept again. This difference only. Now, each night at midnight, Toussaint gathered her dreaming body in his arms and took her to the crypt. She would have been about 21 when I first knew her. Pretty as a picture, although a mite emaciated. Her female flow grew less and less the time she slept, until at last it scarcely stained the rag, and then dried up altogether. But her hair kept on growing, until it was as long as she was herself. Fanny it was undertook the task of combing it and brushing it, for old Four Eyes was a tender woman with a loving heart. The beauty's fingernails and toenails kept on growing too, and it was the Wiltshire Wonder's task to trim them, owing to the marvellous dexterity of her tiny fingers. Because the Sleeping Beauty's face had grown so thin, her eyes were especially prominent, and her closed eyelids were dark as the underskins of mushrooms, and must have grown very heavy during those long slumbering years, for every evening, when she opened her little windows at the approach of the dark, it cost her a greater, even greater effort, as if it took all the feeble strength that remained to her to open up shop. And every time we watched and waited with her supper were afraid that, this time, it might be the last time she would so valiantly strive to wake, that the vast unknown ocean of sleep on which she drifted like sea wrack had that night finally taken her so far from shore on its mysterious currents that she would not return. But whilst I was at Madame Shrek's, the Sleeping Beauty always did wake up, long enough to take a little minced chicken or a spoonful of junket, and she would evacuate a small semi-liquid motion into the bedpan Fanny held under her, and then, with a short sigh, she would sink down again under the soft weight of her dreams. For do not think she was a dreamless sleeper. Under those soft-veined webs, her eyeballs moved continually this way and that, as if she were watching shapes of antique ballets playing themselves out upon the insides of her eyelids, and sometimes her toes and fingers would convulse and twitch, as a dog's paws do when it dreams of rabbits, or she might softly moan or cry out, and sometimes very softly laugh, which was most strange. And once, when Fanny and I were at backgammon one night when trade was slow, the Wonder, giving this dreamer a manicure, cries out of a sudden, "Oh, unendurable!" For beneath those lashes oozed out a few fat tears. "And I had thought," the Wonder said, "she was beyond all pain." Though so diminutive in stature, the Wonder was as perfectly formed as any of those avatars of hers, such as Good Queen Bess's pretty little confidant, Mrs. Thomason, or that Anne Gibson who married the little fellow who painted miniatures, or the beautiful Anastasia Borkolaski, who was small enough to stand under her brother's arm, and her brother was a small man himself. Besides, the Wonder was a most accomplished dancer, and could do high kicks it was just like opening up a pair of embroidery scissors. So I says to her, "Wonder, why do you degrade yourself by working in this house, which is truly a house of shame, when you could earn a good living on the boards?" "Ah, feathers," she replies. "I'd rather show myself to one man at a time than to an entire theatre full of the horrid, nasty, hairy things. And here, I'm well protected from the dark, foul throng of the world, in which I suffered so much. Amongst the monsters, I am well hidden. Who looks for a leaf in a forest?" Let me tell you that I was conceived in the following manner. My mother was a merry milkmaid who loved nothing better than a prank. There was near our village a hill quite round, and though overgrown with grass, it was well nigh hollow since it was burrowed through and through with tunnels like runs of generations of mice. Though I have heard it said, this hill was no work of nature, but a gigantic tomb, a place that those who lived in Wiltshire before us, before the Normans, before the Saxons, before even the Romans came, laid out their dead. The common people of the village called it the Fairy Mound, and steered clear of it at nights, for they believed it was, if not a place accursed, then certainly one in which we human beings might suffer curious fates and transformations. But my madcap mother, egged on by the squire's son, who was a rogue, and better a silver sixpence she would not dare, once spent the whole of one midsummer's night inside this earthen castle. She took with her a snack of bread and honey and a farthing dip and penetrated to the chamber at its heart, where there was a long stone much like an altar, but more likely in all probability to have been the coffin of some long-dead king of Wessex. On this tomb, she sat to eat her supper, and by the light went out, so she was in the dark. Just as she began to regret her foolhardiness, she heard the softest footfall. "Who's there?"
"Why, Meg, who but the king of the fairies?"
And this invisible stranger forthwith laid her down on the stone slab and pleasured her, or so she said, as mightily as any man before or since. "Indeed, I went to Fairyland that night," she said. And the proof of it was 9 months later, I made my infinitesimal appearance in the world. She cradled me in a half-walnut shell, covered me with a rose petal, packed my layette in a hazelnut, and carried me off to London town, where she exhibited herself for a shilling a time as the fairy's nursemaid, while I clung to her bosom like a burr. But all she got, she spent on drink and men, because she was a flighty piece. When I got too big to be passed off as a suckling, I said, "Mother, this won't do. We must think of our security in our old age." She laughed a good deal when she heard her daughter pipe up in that style, for I was only 7 years old, and she herself not 25. And it was a black day for me when I took it into my head to turn that giddy creature's mind to the future, because at that, she sold me for 50 golden guineas cash in hand. My young mother sold me to a French pastry cook with corkscrew moustaches who served me for a couple of seasons in a cake. Chef's hat, perched on his head at a rakish angle, he'd bear the silver salver out of the kitchen and set it down in front of the birthday boy. For the pâtisseur, this much sensibility. I was a treat for children only. The birthday child would blow out the candles and lift up the knife to cut its cake, but the pastry cook kept his own hand on the handle to guide the blade in case it cut me by accident and blemished his property. Then up I'd pop, through the hole, wearing a spangled dress, and dance round the table, distributing streamers, favours, and bonbons. But sometimes, the greediest ones burst into tears and said it was a mean trick, and cake was what they wanted, not a visit from the fairies. Possibly due to the circumstances of my conception, I had always suffered from claustrophobia. I found I could scarcely bear the close confinement of those hollowed cakes. I grew to dread the moment of my incarceration under the icing, and I would beg and plead with my master to let me free, but he would threaten me with the oven and say, if I did not do as he bid me, then next time he would not serve me in a cake, but bake me in a vol-au-vent. Came the day at last my phobia got the better of me. I clambered into my coffin, suffered the lid to close on me, endured the jolting cab ride to the customer's address, was cursorily unloaded onto the salver in the kitchen, and then came the trip to the table. Half fainting, sweating, choking for lack of air in that round space no bigger than a hatbox, sickened by the stench of baked eggs and butter, sticky with sugar and raisins, I could tolerate no more. With the strength of the possessed, I thrust my bare shoulders up through the crust and so emerged before my time, crusted with frosting, blinking crumbs from my eyes. My eruption scattered candles and crystallized violets everywhere. The tablecloth caught fire, and all the little dears screamed blue murder as I ran down the length of the table with my hair and tulle skirt all in flames, pursued by the furious pastry cook wielding his cake knife and vowing he'd make a bonne bouche of me. But one child kept her wits about her in this melee, sat gravely at the bottom of the table until I reached her plate, when she dropped her napkin over me and put out the flames. Then she picked me up and stowed me away in her pocket and said to the pastry cook, "Go away, you horrid man! How dare you torture a human creature so?" As it turned out, this little girl was the eldest daughter of the house. She carried me off to the nursery, and her nanny put soothing ointment on my burns and dressed me up in a silk frock that the young lady's own doll sacrificed for me, although I was perfectly able to dress myself. But I was to find that rich women as well as dolls cannot put on their own clothes unaided. Later that night, when dinner was over, I was introduced to Mama and Papa as they sat over their coffee, of which they gave me some, since it was served in cups of a size that just suited me.
Papa seemed to me a mountain whose summit was concealed by the smoke from his cigar. But what a good, kind mountain it was. And after I told my story as best I could, the mountain puffed a purple cloud, smiled at Mama and spoke. "Well, my little woman, it seems we have no course but to adopt you." And Mama said, "I am ashamed. I never thought that horrid trick with a cake might cause suffering to a living creature." They did not treat me like a pet or a toy either, but as truly one of their own. I soon formed a profound attachment to the girl who'd been my saviour, and she for me, so that we became inseparable. And when my legs could not keep up with hers, she would carry me in the crook of her arm. We called each other sister. She was just 8 years old to my 9. My ship had come to rest in a happy harbour. Time passed. We girls began to dream of putting up our hair and letting down our skirts and all the delicious mysteries of growing up that lay ahead. Although, as for me, I knew I'd never grow up in any worldly sense, which made me sometimes sad. One Christmas came the question of the pantomime. Some 6 cents, perhaps, forewarned me that danger lay ahead. I told Mama that I'd put childish things away and preferred to stay at home that night and read my book. But my sister was lagging a little behind me in the business of maturing, longed to see the bright lights and pretty tinsel, and told me that if I was not one of the family party, then the treat would all be spoiled. I submitted to her tender bullying. As it turned out, the pantomime was Snow White. I turned first fire, then ice in our box as the scenes unfolded before me, for dearly as I loved my family, there was always that unalterable difference between us. Not so much the clumsiness of their limbs, their lumpish movements, oppressed me, nor even the thunder of their voices, as never in all my life had I gone to bed without a headache. No, I had known all these things from birth and grown accustomed to the monstrous ugliness of mankind. Indeed, my life in that kind house could almost have made me forgive some, at least, of the beasts of their beastliness. When I watched my natural kin on that stage, even as they frisked and capered and put on the show of comic dwarves, I had a kind of vision of a world in miniature, a small, perfect, heavenly place such as you might see reflected in the eye of a wise bird. And it seemed to me that place was my home, and these little men were its inhabitants, who would love me, not as a little woman, but as a woman. And then, perhaps the blood of my mother did flow in these scaled-down veins. Perhaps I could not be content with mere contentment. Perhaps I was always a wicked girl, and now my wickedness at last manifested itself in action. It was easy for me to give my family the slip in the crush at the end of the show. Easy to find the stage door and trot past its guardian as he took in a bouquet for Snow White. I soon found the door on which some cruel comic hand had pasted 7 tiny stars. I knocked. Inside, there sat the handsomest young man, on a safe just the right size for both of us, and he was busy mending a tiny pair of trousers with what to your eyes, Feathers, would have seemed an invisible needle and a length of invisible thread. "What pint-sized planet did you spring from?" he cried out when he saw me. Then the wonder covered her face with her hands and wept bitterly. "I shall spare you the sorry details of my fall, Feathers," she said, when she recovered herself. "Suffice to say I travelled with them 7 long months, passed from one to another, for they were brothers and believed in share and share alike. I fear they did not treat me kindly. For although they were little, they were men. How they abandoned me penniless in Berlin, and how I came under the terrible protection of Madame Schreck, her circumstances I relate to myself each night when I close my eyes. Over and over I rehearse an eternity of fearful memories, until the time comes to get up again and see for myself how those who come to slake their fantastic lust upon my small person are more degraded yet than I could ever be." Feathers sighed.
So you see how this lovely creature truly believed herself to have tumbled so far from grace that she could never climb out of the abyss, and she regarded her pretty spotless self with the utmost detestation. Nothing I could say would make her feel she was worth more than a farthing in the world's exchange. She would say, "How I envy that poor being," pointing to the Sleeping Beauty. "Except for one thing, she dreams." But Fanny was another kettle of fish, a big, raw-boned, plain-spoken, hearty lass from Yorkshire, whom you would have passed in the street without a second look, but for the good cheer of roses in her cheek and the spring of health in her step. When Madame Schreck pulled back the curtain on Fanny, there she'd stand, a bonny lump of a girl with nat on but a shift and a blindfold. And Schreck would say,
"Look at him, Fanny."
So Fanny would take off her blindfold and give him a beaming smile. Then Madame Schreck would say,
"I said, look at him, Fanny."
At which she'd pull up her shift. For where she should have had nipples, she had eyes. Then Madame Schreck would say,
"Look at him properly, Fanny."
Then those two other eyes of hers would open. They were a shepherd's blue, same as the eyes in her head. Not big, but very bright. I asked her once, what did she see with those mammillary eyes? And she says,
"Why, same as with the top ones, but lower down."
Yet I do think, for all her free, open disposition, she saw too much of the world altogether. And that was why she'd come to rest with all us other dispossessed creatures, for whom there was no earthly use in this lumber room of femininity, this rag-and-bone shop of the heart. Seeing Fanny holding the Sleeping Beauty's head against her bosom to spoon coddled eggs between those helpless lips, I said, "Why didn't you marry, Fanny? For any man would be glad to have you, once he'd got over the shock, and bring into the world those children of your own you long for and deserve." "Placid as you please," she says. "How can you nourish a babby on salt tears?" And she was always cheerful, always a smile and a joke. But as for cobwebs, she never said much. She was a melancholy creature, and sat by herself a good deal playing patience. That was her life, she said. Patience.
"Why did you call her cobwebs?" asked Walzer, out of his revulsion, out of his enchantment.
"Her face was covered with them, sir, from the eyebrows to the cheekbones. The things that Albert Albertina would do to get to make her laugh. Shahi was a droll one, and always full of fun, but no, cobwebs would never so much as smile." "These were the girls behind the curtain, sir, the denizens of down below, all with hearts that beat, like yours, and souls that suffer, sir."
"And what did you do?"
asked Walser, chewing his pencil.
"Myself. The part I played in Madame Schreck's Chamber of Imaginary Horrors. The Sleeping Beauty lay stark naked on a marble slab, and I stood at her head, full spread. I am the tombstone angel. I am the angel of death. Now, if you wanted to sleep with the Sleeping Beauty, sleep in the passive and not the active sense it was, she being in such precarious health and Madame Schreck loath to kill the goose that laid the golden eggs, if you wished to lie down beside the living corpse and hold in your trembling arms the entire mystery of consciousness that is and is not at the same time, why, that was available, cash down. Toussaint would put a bag over your head and lead you out of the abyss upstairs to the theatre, and there you'd wait. Hear nothing, see nothing, absolute darkness, absolute silence, and you alone with your thoughts, and those phantoms your imagination had distilled from the sight of the girls below. Then Toussaint would spirit the hood off you, and there we'd be. He'd hauled us up from below on a well-oiled dumb waiter in the wall in the interim. Only a branch candlestick cast sombre light and shadow over Beauty sleeping on her bier, and I stooping over, with my bent wings and my sword. Death, the protectress, you see. So if any of them does try to get up to anything not on the tariff, I can wrap them over the knuckles there and then. As for Beauty, she sighed and murmured, and all the time knew nothing. But I would watch the shivering wretch who had hired the use of the idea of us approach her,
as if she were the execution block, and like Hamlet I would think, what a wonderful piece of work is man. By and by, there was a gent started to come marvellous regular, once a week, on Sundays. He always donned the most peculiar costume to venture down below, a sort of velvet frock that came down to his knees, plum-coloured and trimmed with grey fur, and on his feet shiny red leather boots with little bells at the ankles that rang out very sweetly as he walked along. Round his neck, on a gold chain, hung a big medallion of solid gold, most curiously figured, that I often saw Madame Schreck cast her eye on enviously. The figure engraved on this medallion was that of a, pardon my French, member, sir, of the male variety, that is, a phallus, in the condition known in heraldry as rampant. And there were little wings attached to the ballocks thereof, which caught my eye immediately. Around the shaft of this virile member twined the stem of a rose, whose bloom nestled somewhat coyly at the place where the foreskin folded back. Whether the thing was ancient or modern, I could not tell, but it represented a heavy investment. He who sported this quaint jewel was in his later middle years of long, lean, slightly stooping build, with a complexion veering towards the mauvish and mottled, as if he suffered from the cold, but fine, thin features with a high, crooked nose and very close-shaven cheeks, and a pair of wandering, watery blue eyes, eyes of a man unhappy with his world. To finish off his outfit, he always wore a big, round beaver hat, like a drum, that with a brim turned up all round and you could see no hair under it. The first time Madame Schreck lifted up the curtain on me, he jumps half out of his skin and calls out, "Azrael!" After that, he comes only to see me. He wants nothing of the beauty but has me hauled up to the upper room by myself and walks round me, wickering to himself and playing with himself under his petticoat, and Fanny, to tease me, calls him my fancy boy. For 6 Sundays, he arrives to worship at my shrine. But on the 7th, as we girls were sitting down to dinner, Madame Schreck sends a message by Toussaint for me to go and see her. We did very poorly for our dinners in that morbid sepulchre. The tippling old crone in the kitchen would have burned a boiled egg when she got a glass inside her, so Fanny always put up the beauty's invalid diet, and I remember that Sunday especially, because the cook passed out on the Saturday night and Fanny sent Toussaint out to pick up a bit of pork on tick, which he had done. So Fanny bustled about the pans and put a decent leg with crackling and a dollop of apple sauce on the table for us, and just as we was tucking into it, I was summoned to my lady's bedroom, and it was the last Sunday dinner I ever ate in that house. "There's a gentleman made an offer," says Madame Schreck. She's sitting at her desk with her back to me, and only a gas mantle over her, hissing like a snake to give light. "What gentleman and how much?" I asks, immediately suspicious.
"He gives his name as Christian Rosenkreutz, and very generous he is."
"How generous is generous?"
50 guineas to you. Less commission,"
she says over her shoulder, keeping up her scribbling in her damned ledger the while. And all at once I lost my temper with her. "What, 50 rotten guineas for the only fully feathered intactor in the entire history of the world? Call yourself a procuress?" I grabs hold of her shoulder and picks her right up out of her chair and gives her a good shake. She's as light as a bundle of sticks and gives out a faint rattle. As she squawks and, "Take your hands off me!" But I goes on shaking her, until she gasps,
"Well, very well then, 100 guineas.
"Well, pull the other," thinks I to myself. "I don't believe that for one moment, but..." "Madame bloody Schreck," I insist, "you'll not take 1 penny commission either, since you've paid me nothing since those 5 bright shiners 6 months ago, and kept me here as a prisoner since." And I shook her again, until she squeals,
"Very well, no commission. That makes 200 guineas, you bloodsucker."
Then I let her go. "Open the safe," I orders. She goes and roots under her pillow and fetches the key. Very reluctant she is to do it. She scuffles over the floor in her black rags and veil with a sideways scurrying motion, and her head turns from side to side as if she were looking for a rat hole to slip down.
but I'm the avenging angel now and she can't escape me. While her back is turned, I seize the opportunity to shed my blouse and shake out my plumage. She opens out the safe, stretches in her mittened hand, but just as her trembling fingers touch the gold, I catch hold of her shoulders again, and up we go, up, up, up. Thank God